Hello, Bee Culture readers and listeners. Once again, it's that time of the month. Another month has passed and another article has been submitted. Every time I write these articles for you, I have to generate and review and get information, resources, sites, and pictures, recommendations. Some of it's good, some of it's not good. That's what I want to talk about. Beekeeping information, good and bad. I'm Jim Tew. I write for Bee Culture magazine. I write a monthly column on extraneous and typical topics, pretty much related to practical beekeeping. I've entitled this article, Beekeeping Information, Good and Bad, and Telling the Difference is Not Always Easy. You know, I've told you time and time again that I'm not a young man anymore, so the thought is that I've started here is that I have a foot in two worlds. I've discussed this information gathering concept in previous Bee Culture articles, but it's still on my mind, and I doubt that it's ever going to completely go away. Even in my retirement or my downsizing or whatever I've done, every day I must evaluate and choose which bee information and publications are appropriate for whatever my current needs and questions are. Where should I go to get correct beekeeping information? How can I tell when that information that was once good is now no longer considered appropriate? In fact, how can I tell when information presented to me in a nice-looking format on a professional web page is absolutely wrong? So as it were, I have a foot in two worlds. In my earliest years, academics and bee enthusiasts had to maintain a reprint library. At its peak, when you really accumulated a nice library, it would require multiple filing cabinets filled with hard copy reprints of bee research and reviews on as many apicultural subjects as you could accumulate. Of course, some authorities maintained huge libraries, while others had haphazard collections that would catch as catch can. Most of you listening to this, I don't think you can imagine life without the web, life before the web. In my youth, I had to actually go to the real library to do my review work. It took extraordinary amounts of time and energy. At that time, in the 70s, information was dear and generally factual. I suppose few people would spend time concocting incorrect or flimsy information. This library visiting process represents one of my hypothetical feet, or that's in the pre-web world. At the same time, my other foot is in the modern day web world. So you should know that I have no interest, none whatsoever, in going back to the old way. I miss the library and the smell and the quietness and the excitement of finding something, but I can only describe it now as heavenly. To whimsically key in a web search and only seconds later have information that just seems to magically appear. I love this information technology, but I clearly remember the old way of information collection. It was slow, but that information was generally dependable. Now here's the quirk. Even very old information, it can now be found in web-based searches. At one time, I coveted classic old bee books, C.C. Miller and all these writers that wrote important books of the day. They became so very hard to find, and sometimes they were reprints, and they were always expensive, if you could find them at all. In most instances, in digital archival formats, I can now read these classics from beekeeping eras long gone. It's a pleasant read from a bygone era, but is the information still correct? Not always, but it does show where beekeeping was at that time, and there's frequently pictures and diagrams. Readers, I actually put in a listing and a site for where you could go to gutenberg.org and look at an old book that was published in 1949 there on how to line bees. So I tacked that in there just to show you how I can find remarkable information. Generally, people are good, but sometimes they just have bad information. And it's not because they do it on purpose. It's just how it is. In my beekeeping youth, like so many other beekeepers, I had a beloved mentor. Even now, I speak of my very first beekeeping professor with reverence and just a plethora of warm memories. Many professors have such a cadre of graduate students who are forever beholden to them. While my beekeeping professor did not mentor graduate students, he did literally teach, over the years, thousands of undergraduates. And seemingly, nearly every one of them respected this man as an instructor and as a person. I did a footnote here, because it's not it breaks up the flow, but let me do this. I took three or four classes from this man, and it was only in his obituary did I read that he was a distinguished World War II veteran. He was in some of the big-name campaigns that were war-changing battles. He was purple-hearted three times, and he was given a battlefield commission to become an officer because so many of the cadre and the infrastructure had been killed in battle. He never said one word, not one letter of one word about it. And I was a veteran. There were veterans all through the room. He never spoke. He never said anything about it. I didn't know anything about this part of him until he passed on, and it was in his obituary. I want to bring that up because we've just had recently a lot of emphasis given to the anniversary of D-Day, and he was in the thick of that. Back to the article. In 1973, I distinctly remember him telling our B-class participants that drones are colony laggards and contribute essentially nothing to the functionality of the colony. He admonished us at every opportunity, drones should be eliminated. Now, in his defense, the bee world was wildly different in 1972, 73. Other than the organophosphate class of insecticides, everything else was just beekeeping. You know, we had no mites, no small hive beetles, no killer bees. Queens were cheap, flowering weeds were common, and the honeybees were abundant. They were everywhere. So at the time, from a beekeeper's perspective, drones were not that critical to a specific colony in question. But if anyone ever asked a healthy colony if it wanted drones, an entirely different answer would have been presented. This is a good example of bad information being given by an excellent instructor. This is also an old, obsolete memory file that I've just stored away. I will never again use this advice, but the memory file just sits there in my head, waiting for the day to come when it's once again thought to be good management to kill all the drones in our colony. Oh, wait, hold on. Wait just a minute. Isn't that being recommended right now as a form of varroa management? Isn't the bee world odd at times? Years ago, I was at a bee meeting in the upper Midwest. While discussing American foul brood, the speaker confidently and boldly explained that the reason American foul brood has always been such a common problem historically for U.S. beekeepers is that wind easily spreads the disease miles and miles away from the diseased hive site. And this is why, when the bee disease, American foul brood, was encountered, beekeepers with that disease needed to immediately implement a scorched earth policy. Now, listeners, actually, that part is correct. But otherwise, these comments were seriously wrong. Wind plays very little, if any, role in AFB dissemination. Even now, the speaker is still a respected beekeeper in his bee community, as he should be. The rest of the information was rock solid. I was a traveling presenter. I was a visitor, the outsider, far from home and departing the next day. What would you have me do? Later, I told one of the meeting organizers that some of the AFB spore information dispersal procedures should be reviewed, and then I left town. No doubt some of the participants today are still storing those mental files that need to truly be erased. Spotting these embedded errors can really be difficult. When repeated and repeated and repeated, most of these misinformation events easily roll from the tongue and sound factual, and then they get restated many times until the recommendation becomes an accepted tenet that, in fact, is not factual. I've talked about tanging swarms. I love the procedure, and I wish there was something to it. And I have no doubt that this topic will get me some email messages. You see, the thought when you tang a swarm is that once it departs the hive, clanging pieces of metal together will cause the swarm to land. At meetings, I'm told by the occasional beekeeper that doing that very procedure brought a swarm right down to the ground. Well, consider this. It would be impolite, even evil, for me to take that pleasant memory from that beekeeper. There's no science to explain why this would happen, and additionally, the question is begged, how many swarms that were tanged did not come down? Losing a swarm is certainly disappointing. I have honestly had personal experience with that pain. I can also say that, you know, tanging is as good as anything one can do when you're losing a swarm when it's escaping. Playing a loud radio, spraying the swarm with water from a hose, or tossing stones through the swarm would probably have the same effect. The good news is, other than amusing the neighbors, there's no harm done when swarms are tanged. Ironically, alerting the neighbors may have been the early reason that tanging was ever begun as a swarm manipulation. All those hundreds of years ago, it was not an effort to bring the swarm down, but an effort to alert other people that these were your bees, and you were trying to track them down. Double screens for winter survival. I use double screens all the time. They're a common piece of beekeeping equipment. They're useful in oh so many ways. A common management procedure recommendation is to put a smaller colony above a stronger colony and then separate them by this double screen. I don't think I said it in the article, but of course the double screen colony, the upper colony, has its own upper entrance too. It's thought that it would make winter life easier for the smaller colony. Indeed, in some instances, I suspect it could very well do that, but there seems to be so many variables as to make the procedure almost random. How large is the bottom colony? What is the cluster size of the smaller upper colony? How far is the bottom colony from the upper colony? How severe is the winter? Does the warmer, moisture-laden air that rises from the bottom up into the top colony, does that cause a humidity problem for the upper unit? I don't know. Bottom line here, wintering small colonies into the future will certainly be a challenging process. Since this top wintering procedure has been practiced for years without consistent positive or negative results, it seems that this is not the silver bullet answer for wintering smaller colonies. For sure, double screens have, as I said, other uses, such as making spring splits or producing queens. But I just can't really boldly say that putting that small colony on top of a stronger colony separated by a double screen is going to really boost that upper colony. You know, I talked about tanging a bit ago. Drumming is a similar process, and this drumming thing shows signs of factual misinformation. It's not practiced much now, but drumming instructions persist in both new and old literature. Yep, you can find instructions in those ancient digitized bee books that I referred to earlier. When transferring bees from one box to another for whatever reason, the drumming procedure is thought to cause the bees to ultimately abandon their stores, abandon their brood, and the former nest cavity in lieu of a new or different box offered to them on top of this old box. It's a simple procedure. You flip the colony upside down so that the combs are reversed. In other words, the comb bottoms are now upward. Position it near or on the new box. Tap, 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 drum, 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 bump, bump, bang, bang, or thump on the side of the inverted box with something, with hands, with a hive tool, a stone. And you do this for an undetermined length of time with an undetermined level of vigor. And if all goes well, the bees will inexplicably begin to abandon hive and home and move upwardly. Search the web. There's videos and testimonials and that document the success of this procedure. But as is often the case, if this procedure is a sound one, why is it not used for other common bee manipulations? Why is it not a staple of bee management, like removing bees from supers, or driving bees up or out for packet shaking or split making? How about just drumming on the wall of a house to drive the bees out? Doesn't work, does it? So, got some concerns about this old procedure that's been around for a long, long time. Confusingly and interestingly, the electronic media has hybridized this procedure of tanging and drumming. What should this new word be? Trumming? Since this word is now tanging and drumming. So, usually, though, this new recommendation is that if you bang on a wooden surface, it'll cause the swarm to land. I can only say this is just wrong in so many ways. In earlier articles, I wrote that it's presently thought that the bees do not readily sense airborne vibrations. So I made the following arguments. Maybe the bees feel the vibrations within their body. Then how do they exclude the noise of my neighbor's lawnmower or the garbage truck passing or the tractor in the soybean field behind my bee yard? Last year, all summer long, a water tower was constructed a few miles from my home. I could easily see it. And they had to drive something into the ground. There were frequent, rhythmic, metallic sounds coming from the construction site that went on for days on end. And yet I couldn't tell that any of my bees left my colonies. So when does this rhythmic environmental sound cause the bees to leave their colony, and when do they ignore it? Now, all these years later, the following information is commonly available on the web. Speaking of good information going bad, or bad information going good. Yes, honeybees can sense airborne vibrations. They have highly developed sensory mechanisms to detect vibrations and sounds, which are crucial for their communication, navigation, and foraging behaviors. Honeybees primarily detect airborne vibrations through the following mechanisms. I've put this in the article, but for those of you listening, I'm just not going to bore you with it. They're the Johnson's organs located in the second segment of the antennae. It allows the bees to detect and interpret airborne vibration, which is important for their ability to communicate. They have mechanoreceptors on their bodies, particularly the legs and antennae, that can detect vibrations. Of course, the wag dance and the wagtail dance. And then this whole concept of airborne sound detections are more sensitive to substrate vibrations. They can also detect those produced by bees and, in some cases, predators. So, yep, looks like that bees can perceive airborne vibrations. 20 years ago, I was saying, nope, they can't do it, wouldn't do it. So now I just find myself to be uncertain. So no harm seems to be done with the colony, so drum away, but I just can't tell you that it works or not. The eternal argument centers around queen excluders. Either you hate them or you love them. There's only a brief window when an undecided beekeeper is unopinionated on this bee discussion topic. Misinformation and hyperbole flow from both camps. For instance, I use them to keep the grass down in front of my hive. Or, I have always used them, and I never found them to be a problem. Or, these things are nothing more than honey excluders. Or, they call swarming. They clog with burr comb. My favorite description is the one presented by a recent speaker, and he said, "Though I don't like them, and I do not use them, here is a description of the pros and cons of excluders." And I had the thought, well, they're certainly an unbiased source of neutral information. An older publication presented quite a few years ago indicates that without an upper entrance, queen excluders did reduce honey crops. In fact, simply using web-based searches, finding opponents with confirmed opinions to queen excluders is common, but actual objective research findings on something as simple as queen excluders are not, is rare. So, I offer my own unbiased, but emotionally tainted opinion. I have these devices in my storage building right now. I've always had queen excluders in my bee life. Depending on the future schedule, I might use them or I might not. They can be useful when finding a queen that has refused to show herself, and they have specialty uses in queen production or comb honey production. These devices clearly have novel uses and do seem to function to keep the queen confined as needed. So I would conjecture that if maximal honey production is the goal, then I could see how they might hamper foragers from squeezing through them. If maximum efficiency of time is the goal, then I can certainly understand why other beekeepers might use these things all the time. All the reasons to use or not to use these grids are readily available on the web. I refer you to search there. If they fit your need, use them. If they don't fit your need, they're not helpful, don't use them. But I really cannot categorically support the disdain that some has for them. Giving out of time here, I'm giving out of space. There are so many other of these questionable missives. Let me just quickly read some of them. Bees sting you because they're angry. In fact, they do sound angry, but is that enough for us to say that they're angry? Our clothing, protective gear, even the beekeeper, produces an offensive odor to the bees. A speaker once said that to the bees, beekeepers stink. And I had the thought, that's just a bit heavy-handed. Drones follow the queen from the hive as she takes her solitary mating flight. Nope, they don't. Bees hate black-colored clothing or protective items. This can only be because black bears are bees' natural enemies. What if bears are not indigenous to the area? Are bees still instinctually wired to hate bears? Members of a smoked colony engorge on honey in preparation for departing the burning colony. This behavior is probably a holdover from their days in a tropical environment. I find this to be a great story, but what about the queen and the brood? All that going to be abandoned? How will the fleeing colony replace its queen? Bees come to know the beekeeper, ergo strangers or apiary visitors would be treated differently. Yeah, right. Dream on. At one time or another, you're going to all be lit up if you don't do things correctly there. And the last one, and one that I'm kind of sentimental about. When the beekeeper dies, the bees must be told. This process is referred to as telling the bees. This is a quaint procedure. I don't think the bees notice. The beekeeper's not there. But here's the honesty. When I've lost a dear beekeeper friend, it seems to just help me with this personal loss. Even if it doesn't, help the bees. You know, happily, most people are not intentionally trying to mislead other people. They believe the information that they are giving out is helpful and correct, and they practice these procedures themselves. So I can only say we need to all keep an open mind and be kind of leery of broad recommendations that have a miraculous ring. Questioning everything is pretty much okay, and you change your mind when you have to. If you've listened to this point, you're tough, and I deeply appreciate you doing it. Thank you so much. I'm Jim, telling you bye until next month.